The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Want the real story behind the sound bites and headlines? Let's find the facts. Remember, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's the truth. You are not paranoid or confused. You just need to know.
Welcome in, everybody. It's time for another edition of Everything You Need to Know. I'm Kip Kiefer, ready to go off a holiday weekend. I hope everybody had a fantastic Turkey Day and celebration with family and faith and football. Of course, we were all over football this week with all of our programming in that area. Right here on Tony Curry Radio, you can tune in every week to Wanna Bet, our fantastic football show that emanates out of Las Vegas with my son, Case Kiefer, the sports editor of the Las Vegas Sun and the beat writer for the Las Vegas Raiders, who were in Seattle yesterday. So Case was in the press box at the Seattle Stadium and watched an exciting game that the Raiders end up winning in overtime on a walk-off run by former Alabama star Josh Jacobs. So our show is really good every week, and it's really going to kick into high gear now. So you got to make sure that you check it out each week, because last year, between the two of us, we just had a phenomenal record on picking the bowl games correctly. And that's right around the corner now. We're only we're at the end of the regular season, amazingly. And now we have the conference championship games coming up this weekend. So we'll have all the picks on those for you. I'm coming off my best prognostication weekend of the season. I've been picking SEC games all year, and full disclosure, not as well as I would have liked. I was six games below 500 for the year going into this weekend. I made five picks on the SEC, and I'm proud to announce that I hit all five of them. I had one perfect 3-0 weekend when I only made three picks. This time with five, we put five winners out there for you. So I hope you tuned in last week, and we're going to keep that streak going. Now only one game below 500 for the year, finishing with a flourish, I guess you could say, which is a good thing to announce. We had Auburn plus the points against Alabama, and that half point came in big because Alabama, 22.5-point favorite, wins by 22 in the Iron Bowl. Also had Georgia Tech and 33 against Georgia, and they covered that line easily with a 37-14 loss. Georgia still rolling along, but Tech played well enough to cover that big spread. Also loved a game in College Station. A lot of people are giving me accolades for this one because I picked Texas A&M to upset LSU outright, and they did that. They were getting 10 points to boot. But I just felt like LSU is a team, if you really look at their season, they have not been very impressive away from Tiger Stadium. They barely scraped out a win at Auburn. They beat Florida by just a touchdown in a game where they almost blew a big lead, and went on the road to Arkansas a couple of weeks ago, and they were very fortunate that the quarterback for the Razorbacks, KJ Jefferson, did not play in that game, or LSU would have been saddled with another loss, and things could have been different here. They're still going to Atlanta and will face Georgia in the SEC championship game. We will have a complete preview on that this week on Wanna Bet, so don't miss it. The other game I had picked, I took Florida in the points against Florida State, and they covered the spread in a really close competitive game. But I wanted to start kind of on an offbeat subject here on this week's Need to Know. Did anybody watch that game on Friday night, Florida State? It was on ABC. And I don't know where they came up with the broadcast team for that, but it was the worst nightmare of game commentary you've ever heard. The play-by-play guy was the guy named Anish Stoff, who I've never heard of. I don't know what Anish is famous for, but he had to talk really loud to get the play-by-play in because his partner, former NFL quarterback, and let's just call him what he was in the NFL, he was a bust, Brock Osweiler. It was a draft pick by the Broncos back in 2012, and got a big free agent contract a couple years later with the Houston Texans, where he just was abysmal. He is in. These guys were so bad, and Osweiler was so loud and so just absurd with his commentary. They were just kind of like trying to outshout each other. And I was texting back and forth with my broadcast partner, Terry Quillian. She said, I had to turn the sound down. I can't stand this. And Brock Osweiler became the number one trending subject on Twitter during that game. And some of the comments were absolutely hilarious. One guy tweeted that Brock Osweiler, is so bad, I'm just going to have to be compelled to slap him if I ever see him in public. My favorite one was a lady texted, why is Brock Osweiler yelling at me? Hilarious. And then somebody else, as I mentioned, he was a very poor quarterback in the NFL. A guy tweeted, is it possible? Brock Osweiler is a worse commentator than he was a quarterback. I didn't believe that was possible. So it was really an experience. If you caught that game, listening to these two guys at the highest decibels imaginable. And we talked about on our sports show yesterday on the morning after, isn't there anybody in the truck at the game, the producer or the sound engineer or an executive back at ABC headquarters that are going, these guys got to tone it down. This is ridiculous. They had to have been aware that on Twitter it was blowing up how bad these guys were. It was a real extra element, and it went from irritating to hilarious because it just got worse and worse as the game went on. So that was an interesting development from the Thanksgiving football weekend. But don't miss Want to Bet this week, because I think we're on a roll now and can give you some great information going into the championship games, the college football playoff committee selections on Sunday of this week, and then, of course, all the bowl games culminating with the national championship tournament, the four teams, playing two games on New Year's Eve to determine the finalists, who will get together on January 9th at the SoFi Stadium, the brand-new $5 billion colossus in Los Angeles. That's where the college football playoff will take place, the championship game. I want to switch gears and talk about a variety of subjects here that have been on my mind during this holiday weekend. And, I see reports, and I don't think any American can be happy about this, but haven't we heard enough from health officials? Now, all of a sudden, there's all these health officials saying we've got all these new viral strains going on, COVID still lurking around, some kind of respiratory disease. It may be necessary for us to go back to some emergency protocols because this is just getting worse and worse. And mask mandates might need to be considered again. That is absolutely not the case. We do not need to wear masks. They need to be, up to each person's choice. The government does not need to be dictating that because it really doesn't make any difference. And, I hate to get into territory that I don't have any expertise in because I don't know about communicable diseases, but I do have common sense. And when our borders are wide open and over 3 million people have literally strolled into the country and dispersed at all points, who knows where, isn't it kind of suspicious to you that all of a sudden we've got all these new strains of viruses? I mean, we've got people coming in here from all over the world. If you watch any depiction of the old immigration process through Ellis Island in New York, when people would sail over from all over the world, when they disembarked, they had to go through a long line and a process where every one of them were examined. And if they had any kind of issues medically, they were actually quarantined for a few weeks until they were cleared to be, set free in the general population. Of course, that's not going on now. In one of the most awful things, I think, that's going on right now in our country, you've got a lot of, very important first responders and our military, which is already diminished and running low on numbers. And we are kicking people out of those professions. because they won't take a vaccination. And yet at our border, we just are wide open. Come on in, not vaccinated, not checked medically. They just stroll into the country and all of a sudden, wow, what a surprise. We've got all kinds of new strains of sickness we haven't seen before. You know, it just seems to me logically that that can't be a good contributing factor if indeed another health crisis is shaping up. And it doesn't look to me like these are lethal in any way, shape, or form. They're like bad flus and different respiratory problems. The only people that they're really detrimental to are people that have pre-existing conditions and bad health overall. And those people need to be safeguarded all the time, not just because some official pops up and says, oh, you know, it might be time for government to mandate all of this activity again. I don't think government ever has that role unless it's some kind of highly communicable situation. But even in that situation, it's not a good policy for our government to be dictating and violating the individual liberties of all the citizens. You make the choices for your health and your care. And this whole hokum about, well, you're protecting others by doing this. Vaccines have proved to be totally ineffective as far as transmission of the disease. So a flimsy mask is certainly with talking about microorganisms so tiny that no mask is going to control their spread. It's just, once again, this compliance thing, this, you know, big brother telling people what to do in a country that's founded on individual freedom. So that was one thought I had. Keep an eye on that and see if they continue to push this ridiculous agenda some more, because it's really something that disturbs me greatly. This is an interesting sidebar, and some people will classify me as an ugly American when I say it, and I may be guilty as charged on that on a lot of fronts, but it's very interesting. This week in Qatar, where the World Cup is going on, the big soccer tournament for the whole world, guess who the USA is playing in a must-win game if they want to continue on in the tournament? They are playing none other than our big rivals from Iran. That's right. The same Iran that once took the American embassy in Tehran and all of the personnel hostage for 444 days. The same Iran who has been the number one organizer and financer of terrorism around the world for years. The same Iran who's developing nuclear weapons right now and is vowed to destroy Israel. The same Iran whose national chant is death to America. So we're going to throw down and have a friendly soccer game in the World Cup against Iran. We've kind of been on the offensive already a couple of years ago during the Trump administration. Their general, their military leader, Soleimani, landed at the Baghdad airport, supposedly organizing a attack on the American embassy in Iraq. And unfortunately for Mr. Soleimani, the Americans got word of his arrival. This was the guy who was credited with being the number one terrorist in the world, and really at the root of countless attacks and deaths of not only Americans, but people all over the world. Soleimani had gotten in a car and was being tracked by the U.S. military, and a drone strike took him out just a couple of years ago. So, you know, it's an interesting dynamic that we are playing in a soccer game, the country that is really at the root of so much of the evil in the world right now, with their terrible fundamentalist regime at the controls. And the citizens of Iran are rising up, and we give them no support whatsoever, which is very distressing. You know, a couple of months ago, a young lady was arrested for not having her headgear deployed perfectly or whatever to comply with the rules, speaking of governments that do not allow their citizens any liberties whatsoever. they took her into custody, and mysteriously, she ended up dying. She was like 23 years old, and the country has been kind of up in arms about it ever since. She was obviously beaten to death in jail. So they've been protesting the streets recently. And, you know, the one thing I am kind of interested in to see playing against the United States in soccer now is going to be such an event that's going to be really scrutinized and watched by everybody in the world. I want to give the Iran soccer guys a lot of credit, because when they played the Iranian national anthem before their first game in the tournament against England, those guys didn't react. They looked blank faced. They didn't sing along like they're instructed to. And so obviously it was their form of protest in their own government. But I just find the correlation of a fellowships, you know, and that's what the Olympics and the World Cup and any kind of sporting events. I don't want to bring politics into sports at all, but how can you not think about it when the USA is playing Iran on the world stage? It's kind of remarkable to think about. These people, this country, this regime has been our sworn enemy and at the root of so many things that have happened in the recent past, going back to the 1980 American embassy seizure. And our citizens were held again 444 days. That's kind of hard to forgive. And in the meantime, if that's not enough, we have been negotiating with them for a number of years and actually signed an agreement that was taken away when Donald Trump came into office. But the Obama administration had signed a treaty supposedly to cut back on their ability to produce a nuclear weapon, when these are the last people. You don't want fanatics to have a deadly existential weapon in their hands. So now that those negotiations under the Biden administration have continued, but Iran is so angry at the United States for rescinding the last agreement, which basically had no teeth. We didn't even have inspection capability. They were able to do pretty much whatever they wanted. Meanwhile, our part of the deal was releasing billions of dollars of their currency that was frozen in U.S. banks and investment firms. It comes down to the Iranians are so angry at the Americans for their rescinding of that original agreement, which was the best deal ever for their country. The U.S. got nothing. They got everything. That they will not even negotiate with American representatives. The middleman, the negotiator representing the American interests. And think about this. The negotiators across the table from the Iranians negotiating this treaty for them to cut back on nuclear activity are the Russians. Now, how rich is that? The Russians always are in lockstep with us as far in terms of interest. Meanwhile, we're financing a war with billions of dollars to fight Ukraine against the Russians, while the Russians sit down at a negotiation table and represent us talking to the Iranians. It's just crazy stuff. I mean, this is like lunatic time. My partner, Terry Quilligan's dad, was a judge for a long time. And when things really got out of hand, he used to tell her, I need to issue a lunacy warrant. Well, that's really what needs to be issued. But it will be very interesting to watch the soccer game and see if the emotions run high in the USA versus Iran matchup. I just find it kind of amazing that they're in the same four-division little pod where you play the other three teams. I wonder if somebody with kind of a warped sense of geopolitical humor made that arrangement, because when I saw who the U.S. was scheduled to play, and let me say this, as far as soccer's concerned, I won't be watching the game, even with all of these interesting implications. Because I, again, am an ugly American. I don't care for soccer. I don't think it's exciting. I don't think it's interesting. I don't want to watch guys run up and down the field and have very few scoring chances and the crowd going wild like there's actually something going on. I don't like when a guy gets bumped and falls on the ground, that he lays there in the fetal position for about 10 minutes acting like he's seriously injured, trying to induce the referee to pull out a red card and throw the guy who bumped him out of the game. I really don't like, and the most ridiculous thing about soccer is, the extra time. The referee runs around with a little notepad, and anytime there's a stoppage in the game, when a guy's curled up on the field, because the clock runs the whole time, the clock doesn't stop. So he keeps notes in his little book of how much time elapses of kind of dead time when the clock is running and there's no action going on. And then you play what's called extra time. And okay, the referee doesn't announce to the press box upstairs, okay, we've got 12 minutes of extra time. He is the only one in the 100,000 throng that knows how much, quote, extra time is left. The referee decides how much, okay, we're going to play 13 extra minutes, or maybe we'll just play as long as I, you know, want to watch some more action. It's the craziest thing. I can't understand why you can't put the extra time on the clock so people know how much time's left in the game. And to hear commentators on soccer say, well, we've got to be running short on time. You know, we figured it would be 13 or 14 minutes of extra time. It's only up to one man, and he's the only one in the stadium who knows it. So I find those things to be absolutely confounding about soccer, not to mention the fact I just don't think the game's very exciting. I've been watching the scores come across the bottom of the screen during football games and noticed that a lot of the games end 0-0. Now, why would you go sit in a stadium and cheer and be all fired up for 3.5 hours for a game where not a single team manages to score and there's no overtime? It's just a 0-0 tie. They play the extra time, and you know, I'm sorry. I don't understand how watching Mexico and Poland play to a 0-0 tie, or the compelling matchup between Denmark and Tunisia ending up 0-0. And the Americans, their big game with the English last week, the English, one of the favorites in the tournament, the Americans considered it a victory because they held the English to a 0-0 tie. Man, I'm telling you, the old line about paint drying, I think that would be a lot more interesting in some cases, particularly if it's a compelling color to look at. So anyway, that's my soccer take, the World Cup take. U.S. versus Iran, I won't be watching, but I'll be very interested to see highlights and see the final score and see what kind of emotions well up in that particular game. Hey, I also wanted to talk about here something that I should have gotten into last week, but I had kind of a full plate. I was talking about Wampanoag Indians and pilgrims and all that good things for Thanksgiving. But another important anniversary date passed last week of what I consider probably, well, I won't say probably, I think it's absolutely the darkest day in American history in the entire time our country has existed. And that was, of course, the November 22nd, 1963 assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, our president, young, vibrant, just coming off the successful management of one of the great crises our country ever faced, the Cuban Missile Crisis in October, November 1962. He was campaigning in Dallas, Texas for a re-election run that would have been in 1964, riding in an open limousine through Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas, Texas, and was shot and killed, of course, with his resplendent First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, sitting inches away from him in her fabulous Pierre Cardin pink suit and the now infamous pink pillbox hat. You know, it always has struck me as a day that everything changed in our country. I think people's distrust in government and also the government's reluctance to really tell people what's going on, which is our right as a citizen. And it's become, I think that day was day one of suppressing information and not telling people exactly, you know, the truth. The Warren Commission was put together, which was a group, it was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren, and a bunch of senators and lawyers that investigated the Kennedy assassination and published an 888-page report that basically said nothing. Lee Oswald did it. He was on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. There's no evidence of a conspiracy. But these people, despite interviewing or taking depositions from over 500 witnesses, really did not contact a lot of people that came forth in the years following that and had real information and had real sources on ties that Oswald had to a lot of nefarious characters. I don't dispute, after years of studying that event, that Lee Harvey Oswald was the gunman and was responsible for what happened that day as the limousine made a 90-degree turn and went down Elm Street toward the expressway to go out to the place where the lunchtime speech for Kennedy was scheduled. But looking at the scene, and I've been to Dealey Plaza twice, and let me tell you, if you have not been there, it will really change your perspective of exactly what happened, or maybe what you've learned or accepted over the years, because it is really a place of unbelievable contemplation. I have stood in the window of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, the very spot that Lee Oswald occupied. That whole floor now is basically a museum and a remembrance of that day. They've got all kinds of interesting artifacts and fabulous photos. And it was a day that America still had great hope for the future and great vitality with a young leader, vibrant leader. And, you know, there was the old song about the day the music died. I think it's arguable the day that our trust in ourselves and our country died, along with John F. Kennedy. Standing in that window, I was really struck, and this is what I think everybody would appreciate. You're always led to believe that he had to be some kind of expert marksman to pull this off. And really, if you stand there, I was amazed that, and I'm not a gun guy at all. I know nothing about firing weapons. I've never target shot. I don't know how difficult it is. But the amount of distance was so much closer than I ever imagined, looking down to the spot in the street, and you can't miss it. There's a giant white X right on the pavement of the spot where the president was shot, just below the sixth floor window. And, you know, looking at the distance and the you know, challenges of making those shots, I really don't think it took some brilliant display of marksmanship. I was really, really surprised to see that in terms of just the sheer distance. It was not very far. It was a close shot. It was, if you're going to have an assassination, that was the ultimate killing field, because they talk about a military tactic, triangulation of fire. You had the buildings on both sides and a narrow street where you had to make a 90-degree turn to turn down the street. So you couldn't build up any speed, not to mention the fact that the motorcade was just crawling along because there were people everywhere on both sides. Kennedy was getting a huge positive reception that morning in Dallas on his way to make his lunchtime speech at the Texas Trade Center. It changed my perspective that, you know, this was some kind of, you know, expert maneuver. Lee Oswald was a former Marine, had gotten some accreditations for his shooting, and he was 24 years old at the time. Of course, after the Kennedy assassination on Friday afternoon, Lee Oswald himself was shot and killed. And you talk about bringing in the age of television. Television still in its infancy was covering the transfer of Oswald from the city jail in Dallas to the county jail, which was a more secure facility, and brought him down. The Dallas police did not secure the building. Jack Ruby, a nightclub owner who did have a lot of ties to organized crime, but a lot of those were never even investigated. Jack Ruby strolled down the tunnel and stepped out from the crowd and shot Lee Oswald at point blank range right in the stomach on live television. One of the most shocking things that you can ever possibly imagine. And it was an immediate announcement that life was never going to be the same, because we were going to see events as they happened from now on, instead of just buying the newspaper the next day. So it's always a subject that's fascinated me. If you get a chance to go to Dallas, go to Dealey Plaza and just stand right there on the curb, 5 feet from the giant X in the street, and contemplate what that meant to our country, to our future, and where we are now. I maintain it was the most significant negative day in the history of the United States. That's pretty much it for this week. I always enjoy coming to you all. I get these kind of random list of things I want to talk about, but next week I'm going to prep a show a little bit, give you a little bit of a promotion. I am doing extensive research and trying to learn everything I can. I'm sure many of you have heard about this new reprehensible character, Sam Bankman-Fried, who was running the FTX Corporation, which was really just an animal house operation of getting people to send money for different cryptocurrencies. And in the meantime, he and his fraternity, sorority, brothers and sisters in this venture, who lived in a building they bought in the Bahamas, were just recklessly spending all the money that these people were sending to invest in, who were thinking they were making some kind of investment situation. This guy makes Bernie Madoff, who was the great scammer from New York, who ripped off people for millions of dollars. Bankman-Fried got into the billions category. So I'm learning all I can about that. I don't even really understand a lot about cryptocurrency. I've been puzzled by its presence for a couple of years, but I'm going to have a full report next week on Need to Know and tell you everything you need to know about the whole FTX collapse, bankruptcy. And of course, the reason you're not hearing about that from mainstream media is because they were a huge financing wing for the Democrat Party. Bankman-Fried had already pledged to give Joe Biden $1 billion for his reelection campaign. Well, Joe, I wouldn't be looking for that check in the mail, because they are kaput. I also like the fact that Major League Baseball is wearing a big face full of you-know-what, because their umpires all year had a giant FTX logo on their shirts when they umpired games, a sponsor of Major League Baseball. And I'm still kind of angry at them for taking the All-Star game away from Georgia 2 years ago for the terrible crime of requiring ID when people vote. That's it for this week. I hope everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving and are looking ahead with great anticipation to the Christmas season. I'm Kip Kiefer. Thank you to everybody for listening. I always am delighted to be able to come to you right here on Tony Curry Radio. We will see you this same time next week.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.